This week's show is brought to you by Avlia Modern Folk Embroidery and Sassy Jack Stitchery. Avlia Modern Folk Embroidery you find at avlia.life. And if you visit their website, designer Krista West has set things up very easily for shopping. She has a whole section for beginners, a section for meditative stitching, and if you're a regular follower of Fiber Talk, you know that we did a series not too long ago of live shows on meditative stitching. It's a wonderful area to explore, and Krista West's kits are excellent for that kind of stitching, just sitting and letting your mind go and enjoy the rhythm of needle and thread. So check those out. Then she has several embroidery hoop kits, and my favorite place these days in her website is her pomegranate collection. And those are PDF downloads that you can purchase for $5. And they're a wonderful collection of designs. And as with just about all of Krista's designs, you can take those in their repetitive pattern. So you can make them as big or as small as you want. And you can make a table runner, a mat, a coaster, whatever you want out of these patterns. And the pomegranate collection she's adding to on a regular basis, really worth exploring, especially at the $5 price range. And then if you really want some beautiful Mediterranean-inspired designs, go to the table runners and mats section, because that stuff is just stunning. Really beautiful work. So visit avlia.life and explore the Mediterranean-inspired designs from Krista West and pick up a couple of kits to add to your stash and your stitching enjoyment. Our second sponsor this week is Sassy Jack Stitchery, and here is a word from Kim.
Sassy Jack Stitchery is happy to be a sponsor of Fiber Talk. We so appreciate all the heart that Gary and team put into their show, and we always look forward to each episode. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for all you do for our needlework world. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant needlework shop located in the mountains of western North Carolina, just north of Asheville. We're in the process of moving our shop to its forever home in a historic folk Victorian on the National Listing of Historic Places, just 3 miles down the road from our current location. While we're moving, you can find us in all our normal online haunts, our website at sassyjackstitchery.com, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We can't wait to open our doors and welcome you into our new old home. It was always the plan to be in this beautiful old house, and we've invested a huge chunk of our hearts into its renovation. Every renovated board, every push-button light switch, every old porch swing has lovingly, mostly, been placed there with our own hands. It has a wonderful, warm, welcoming feel about the place already, and your stitchy joy and laughter with friends will really make it home for Sassy Jack's. So look for us online for the next few months, as we'll be filling online and phone orders as per usual, and we'll be looking forward to the spring at the Baird House in Asheville, North Carolina. When the time comes, we'll leave the light on for you, just like your mom did when you were a kid, so you'll know it's time to come home. Now on to the show.
Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, this is going to be fun, Lindsay Olson. Lindsay, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Gary.
Oh, this is right up my alley here. We're going to combine needlework, textile art, and science.
I'm excited, and I think you're the perfect person to interview me.
Well, I hope so. I hope so, but you don't usually combine science and needlework. It just doesn't fit together, but you've done an amazing job with this thing. So, always an artist?
I would have to qualify that, I guess. I grew up in a household with a bunch of needlers. So my mother was very fond of Erica Wilson kits, so I grew up hanging around that. She was also a knitter, so I'm a fourth generation knitter. Both my grandmothers sewed or tatted or cross-stitched or needle-pointed. My sister is a sewer and a quilter right now. And I grew up in that atmosphere, but there were no real professional artists in my family. So once I got out of high school, I worked for a little while, tried college here and there, and academics were not something I was ever really very good at. And I ended up studying fashion design for a while and worked at a couple of fashion design houses until my kids were born. And then I taught sewing for a few years, and then I decided that I needed to go to art school. And that was a really big experience for me. It was wonderful. I went to Columbia College Chicago and graduated with a degree in fine arts.
But not, but through school, through high school, not really something you were oriented toward.
Not in in any kind of organized way. I would do a lot of stitching on my own. I would design my own embroideries, for example, or I did a lot of sewing, garment sewing, and knitting. I was a really big knitter, but not in art class. You know, art class was not something I really focused on.
So what makes you go to Columbia? I mean, Columbia is not a school where you monkey around. I mean, that's serious stuff. What makes you say, all right, I'm going to go there and get an art degree?
Well, I had been working in fashion design for a number of years. And although that was very interesting and I learned a great deal and I had a very good work ethic, it was not a great fit. And I think in some ways it was a compromise for me. It was less scary than going to art school since I didn't really have any experience in the fine arts area. So it was a compromise between something useful and something that interested me. And it was good for a while. But then I thought, you know what? I need to just take my courage in hand, apply to art school, and just see what happens.
That's gutsy. That's gutsy. Yeah. People I've talked to in the fashion world, that it has, it's become clear to me, it either fits you or it doesn't. That's, that's a different place. Yes.
Yeah, it is. It's very high pressure, fast paced, commercial, very heavily commercial kind of enterprise.
So when you go to Columbia, something in mind, or did, were you just there with your blank slate? Let's see what happens.
You know, my first goal was to learn how to draw, because I had never really learned how to draw realistically in any class, any formal way. And I had been drawing for a couple of years on my own before I went to college. And then when I got there, it was like, oh my God, I loved drawing. I loved the discipline. I loved the various different ways to approach a drawing, from line quality to contrast and value, moving shapes around and studying two-dimensional design. I just took all the fundamental classes that I could, and I loved it. And I took a couple painting classes, and after graduation, that's really what I worked on, was oil painting.
But just didn't find that as a long term. It just didn't fit you.
Well, the first project that I started working on pretty intensively after graduation was something called the Waterways Project. And I was taking all the local area waterways and painting them in a kind of idealized way. So I would edit out stuff like bridges and parking lots and wires. And around this time, my husband and I actually bought a canoe. And as often as I could convince him to do this, I would be painting in the bow and he would be paddling in the back.
Okay, wait a minute. There, now there's a mental image for you. That's excellent.
Yeah. You got to love this guy, right?
That's good. Okay.
So one day we were on the Calseg Channel and we passed beautiful, beautiful engineered waterfall. It's called a SEPA station. And it was in the middle of nowhere. It was somebody had spent so much money on this, and I couldn't understand why there was all this engineered beauty in the middle of nowhere. So finding out who built that structure and why led me to the MWRD, the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Chicago. And they're the people that process all the wastewater from Cook County in Chicago. And once I got there, I learned so much about the wastewater treatment process that I thought, you know what, I really have to do something with this that's really personal. And so I decided to switch to textiles because they're so approachable. They're so tactile. And also, I really, really dislike washing brushes. So that was like the perfect confluence of leaving painting and moving into textile work. It's okay. True. It's true. Have you ever cleaned watercolor, or have you ever cleaned oil brushes? It's just a nightmare.
I only remember when I was a young kid cleaning oil-based paint for house painting and what a turpentine and all that. So, no, I would not enjoy that. I can understand why you'd hate that. Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a total pain.
So, okay, she leaves water or leaves oil painting because the brush cleaning is too much. The maintenance is too high. Okay. I like that. The maintenance is too high. Yeah. Yeah. So you saw, okay, so you see this wastewater treatment plant, the kind of thing that most people, when they get near it, will turn left and get away from it. And somehow you see art there.
Well, it was such an amazing experience because here I was painting idealized waterways all these years, and then to look at a piece of engineering that someone intentionally put in the canal to oxygenate the sluggish water, and to learn about the real story of water, to me felt like an extremely powerful concept to pursue. I was very curious, and all of a sudden, water mattered to me in a completely different way. So forget about the idealized water. The real story of water is so much cooler.
Intrigues me. All the reading I did about you is there's zero science in your background. I mean, right. I didn't pick up on any indication of any interest at all. And then you hit this juncture and you, it's like science just jumps on you and you connect the two. It's an amazing thing that has happened.
Well, you know, I've always been somebody who was willing to take a risk. Mm-hmm. And I think what that means is that I really never look before I leap. And I think had I known what it was going to be like to walk into a wastewater treatment plant, or wait a minute, back it up, to first talk my way into doing art about wastewater treatment, which is a whole process in itself. That was so big and so huge that once I got in there, it was like, well, gee, I guess I better do something with this now.
Yeah, talking your way in. Yeah, I can see that. A lot of eyes rolled. Hey, you got this person over here. I don't know what she's trying to do, but you talk to her. Yeah. And wastewater treatment plants, I mean, the magazine I edit, Manufacturing Magazine, that's one of the topics we cover. Very high-intensity operation with a lot of maintenance, pumps, motors, chemicals, the whole shooting match. And I mean, people don't think they're all that complex, but there's just an awful lot to them. And you just walked right into the heart of it and said, I see some art there.
It was an amazing experience because, yes, I had never been in an environment where I had to wear a hard hat or safety shoes.
Right.
Or I have no science background whatsoever. So I would walk into these monthly lectures that the MWRD would put on for continuing education for the staff. And I'd be able to understand like maybe 10% of what mm-hmm. the engineers were discussing in these lectures. But I realized, you know, I can do an awful lot with 10%. And in addition to that 10%, when you talk to people who are so passionate about their work, this is why I love working with scientists, because I piggyback on their enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And it's infectious. And it's really quite amazing to learn about a process like wastewater treatment that everybody depends on. I mean, a third of us would not be alive today were it not for the invention of clean drinking water and wastewater treatment. So we all depend on this, but hardly anybody knows anything about it. And it was just so cool to learn about it.
Now, did you see this as an opportunity to educate? Like,
yes.
Like you could be a conduit for those who don't understand, or was it just an art outlet?
No. It was both from the beginning. It was all of a sudden this light bulb went on in my head and I thought, I can actually use my art for something useful. It mm-hmm. can do a job in the real world. And this combination of feeling like my art would be useful and meaningful to other people, and attaching myself to ideas that were larger than my own life, my own thoughts, my own studio, that combination was extremely inspiring and powerful for me.
Science is its own language. It's its own mindset. And if you're not exposed to it and kind of grow up with it a little bit, it can be hard to pick up. How did you approach that part of it?
It's taken me a long time to figure out how I do this, because everyone is always asking me, well, how do you figure out how to make art about science? The very first thing, and it's interesting that you mentioned language, because the very first part of any project I start has to start with a glossary of terms. I have to understand the words that people are speaking to me about their various professions. So once I get some of the terms down and some of the basic concepts, that is my way in. And I was trying to think of how best to describe this, but I work out of a number of different books. Like, I have a three-ring binder that is a project folder that organizes supplies and techniques. I have a science notebook where I write down by hand and diagram a lot all the science that I'm learning. And then I also have an artist sketchbook. And none of these things are very tidy. They're very messy. And I'm always moving back and forth between these three books.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow or another, in all that switching of gears, that's the magic thing for me, is the ability to switch gears from, if I'm going down the science path, I get a little stuck on a concept, I switch over to the art side and I start working out some of the details about making the art or the design of the art or the materials or colors or whatever. And somehow that loosens me up to relax about the science, and then I can go back to learning more science. So it's this bouncing back and forth that's really helped me learn. It's helped me figure out how to create the art I do.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how do you, when you walk into a wastewater treatment plant or, you know, water plant of any kind, whether it's wastewater or just pumping water from a spring, I mean, there are several layers of technology there. Yet you ended up focusing on the biology, the microbes, the breaking down of waste and creating fresh water. Were there other areas that attracted you, or did you blow right by all the mechanical stuff to get to the biology?
Oh, no. I spent several months in the pump house a couple times a week. And that is a 6-story building on the premises. Actually, you know, it's important to know that that Stickney plant with the MWRD is a 1930s Depression-era facility. And in those days, they didn't build small facilities. They built gigantic ones. So it's actually the world's largest wastewater treatment plant. So the pump house is huge. And it was really important to understand that hydrology is governed by gravity, whether it's in nature with streams and lakes and rivers and waterfalls of any kind, or it's the wastewater treatment facility, because that facility is geographically located at the lowest point in the city, because water is really heavy and you want to use gravity to bring all that water to the lowest point in the city. And then at the wastewater treatment plant, you lift it one time. You spend the energy and the money to lift the water up to the highest point in the plant, and you use gravity to completely feed it through the system of cleaning the water. And then it's put back into the waterway at the end of the process. So connecting my water waste project, my understanding and my visual cues of how nature deals with hydrology was what engineers borrowed to set up the plant. And that was a very good connection for me to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the same process that's used to clean wastewater treatment in the aeration tanks is exactly how nature cleans rivers, lakes, streams, fresh water. It's just that the engineers have figured out a way to speed up that process.
Right. Yeah, people often think that there's some magic that happens there, but no, it's just nature at a very fast pace. Yes.
Yeah, like someone once asked me, oh, do you have to like add the microbes into the aeration tanks? The brilliant thing is no, because they come from our bodies. We've evolved
yep.
So that the microbes that inhabit our guts eat our poop. Mm-hmm. And it's like this perfect circle of life thing. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is the beauty of it. Yep. There's no no high-end Monsanto chemical factor here. It's just good old nature. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's great. So then I struggled to find the mental connection between seeing all this go on and then finding the biology and then saying the best way to express that is through textile art. seemed like there were a couple leaps of faith in there to make that happen.
You know, when all the time I was in art school, I was learning about design, I was learning about drawing skills, I was learning about composition and painting and expressing myself in two dimensions, but I never really took a formal class in textiles. But the thing about wastewater treatment is that there's such a large yuck factor that I thought, if I'm going to use this for educational outreach, I need to find a way to shrink the distance between the science and the art and the viewer. And so it was like coming home to just pull out all different kinds of fabric. And the treatment plant was that this industry is so incredibly diverse. You walk into this workplace and there's people who are engineers, there's scientists, there's operators, there's people who keep the facility clean. There's people of every different color, race, religion, everything. And I thought textiles would be a very good way to express this diversity because I can use silks, cottons, linens, denim, canvas. I even used a kind of non-woven material that was an absorbent spill catcher in the pump house. I found a source for that kind of textile. And I put that all into the work. And I thought, this is why textiles are so powerful, because you don't really need an art degree to appreciate just how yummy textiles are. And they're very sensuous. People want to touch them, which is kind of a drag if you want to preserve your art pieces. but it also lures people in, and it makes them feel more welcome.
You're even able to find textiles in the plant that were useful.
Yeah, that was really surprising.
That's great. So then, all right, so you see that happening. What is the reaction? You got a bunch of hard workers in a plant like that. What's the reaction you get when you show up with the artwork? Did they connect with it?
Here's the thing. If I do my job well and I learn the science and I take the time to learn the culture of the lab I'm working in or the facility that I'm working in, when I create the art, it's showing people a visual reflection, a way of visually respecting what this person's life's work is all about. So when I showed the microbiologists what I had put together, I'd hung everything in a conference room and invited them to come in and take a look. I was really nervous.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Because I was like, oh my God, did I really get it? So the microbiologists are going, oh, that's filamentous bacteria 095. Or, you know, that's Begiatoa. And they were so thrilled.
You
got
them.
It was such a moving experience, especially in an industry where people are underappreciated, and I wanted their work to look heroic because it's environmental work at a fundamental level that supports all of us and helps keep all of us healthy, but it's not well recognized.
Mm-hmm. So you elevated them through your art then?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You got it.
Great. Wow, that must have felt good. Well, good to know that you got the science right, that they would connect with that. That's a win.
Yeah.
Wow. So then an exhibit there, and then I assume that you used that exhibit elsewhere as an educational piece?
Yes. Actually, I showed at an international water conference at McCormick Place in Chicago. I showed at a state WEF conference in downstate Illinois. I've shown it in a number of libraries, but it's a little bit hard to place that work. And it requires a certain location because of the yuck factor.
Right.
But everywhere I've put it, people have been very, very responsive. Librarians have been so good about placing this work in their galleries.
Hmm. And so now take this back to Columbia. At the time, you're still connected with Columbia? And
No, I had graduated by this point.
You're done with that then. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So this was strictly on your own.
Right. This was after I'd graduated.
Yeah. Did you feel at that point, this is what I can do, this is what I should look to do, even as a full-time thing? Or was this still just kind of a, well, that was fun to do, interesting experience?
Well, I definitely knew that I wanted to use my art in a meaningful way. I wanted to use it as outreach. I was a little bit hesitant to use to take on yet another science project because it was really hard. It was really challenging, and I was always working at the edge of my intellectual capacity to make that project. But in trying to find a place to show this work, which was a little bit challenging, I ran across Fermilab, which has a long history of art and science connection, and they have an art gallery there. And the person who's in charge of the art gallery is Georgia Schwender. And so I contacted her and said, you know, would you be interested in showing this work about art and science? And so she, I think she came to one of my shows and we talked a little bit, and then she invited me out to Fermilab to take a look at the gallery. And when I went out there, she, in the middle of the conversation, I was so shocked. She looked at me and said, oh, would you like to help me establish the first artist in residency here? I've been wanting to do that for a long time. So my first thought was,
wait a minute. It literally happened that way.
Yes, it really, literally, I mean, I fell into this. It literally happened this way. So I think it was a moment where both Georgia and I had goosebumps. We were both very kind of like, wow, this is really going to happen. My second thought was, wait a second. This isn't just like terrestrial physics. This is high energy physics. This is really abstract stuff. But again, my proclivity to not look where I'm leaping and just say yes got me.
Well, yeah, that's because that's just it. When I was reading about you and yeah, the story starts out in the wastewater treatment plant and go, okay, you know, with some effort, you can understand what goes on there and grasp it enough that you can express it through your art. I can see that happening, someone who's willing to work at it. But then to go to high energy physics, I mean, those folks aren't normal. They operate at a level that you know, we just can't connect with in a lot of ways. And you found a way to not only get in there, but to develop enough understanding and to communicate with those guys. That to me, I just kind of had to sit back and go, wow, it was you know, really a tip of the cap to you for at some point just being ignorant in a positive way and just diving in and seeing what happens. I mean, that's impressive to me.
Well, thank you very much. I had a lot of help. I mean, physicists, high energy physicists, they know this is a tough sell. And yet, when you have to create a research project in high energy physics, it requires just an enormous amount of money and organization to set up these giant experiments. I mean, if you think about the Large Hadron Collider or the ring at Fermilab, these are very expensive things. And oftentimes, physicists have to go to taxpayers or lawmakers to request money or to the government for grant writing and partnerships. And so the physics community, especially the high energy physics community, has become very invested in outreach and in outreach that all of us can understand. And this is what I learned when I went to Fermilab. There were so many videos and books and tours and intelligent people who would speak to me respectfully as someone who knew nothing about high energy physics. They were just pleased that I was helping them with their mission of getting the word out about how cool fundamental particle physics is.
Okay, well, that helps me understand that because usually physics, anybody in physics, once they start talking, your eyes just glaze over and like, whatever.
Well, there are some people who are like that, but there are also some other people like Dr. Don Lincoln, who was my advisor, my science advisor, who write brilliantly on the level of popular science. Mm-hmm. He has quite a following of people who are very interested in high energy physics because of his work.
Now he was a real.
Not only is he a great scientist, but he's a really lucid author.
Yeah, he was a real linchpin in this whole thing for you.
Yes, yes, he certainly was. He took the time to explain things to me. And I remember taking one of his books on vacation with me at the very beginning of the project, before I even knew he was going to be my advisor. And in the very first chapter of this book that he'd written, he talks about the standard model. And the standard model is to particle physics what the periodic chart is to chemistry. It's the basics of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to read that first chapter like 20 times. I'm not kidding. And I'm thinking to myself, a little more panicky with each reading of that chapter, going, geez, if I don't even understand what's happening in the first chapter, how in the heck am I going to like create the art for the rest of this project? So understanding that first chapter about what the standard model meant and what life was like on the inside of atomic particles, you know, what happens inside protons and neutrons, that was very key. And then, of course, when I met Don, then I had a lot more resources, and also I, you know, went on tours for several tours at Fermilab, got to speak to a number of people. I actually ended up being allowed to take radiation worker safety training. Georgia was really instrumental in helping me line up that training, because then what I could do was I could follow the operators into the guts of the experiment and mm-hmm. find out all about the neutrino research, literally from the ground up. And that was pretty cool.
Oh, well, just the training had to be an experience like none other.
You had to take a test at the end, too, and you had to pass. I think I, like, barely squeaked in, but yeah. I made it.
What's Mom doing? Really, she's studying. She's studying for a radiation test. Just leave her alone.
Right. I'm really proud of that, getting through that course. That was a pretty big deal for me.
Well, yeah, I would say so. Definitely a big deal. And then, of course, yeah, that opens up that whole other world of actually being able to go right into the center of the operation. Oh, boy, I can't tell you how envious I am of what you've been able to do. It's so neat for you.
Yeah, that was a very privileged view.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not normal. So then Don is with you through this whole process, your sounding board, your... get you over the hurdles person?
Between Don and Georgia, I would go in with science questions or like, I guess within the first couple of months of the project, I went away for a few months and thought about the standard model, and I started working on those standard model pieces, and I brought them in to show Don, and again, with a bit of trepidation, and explained to them what I was doing, and he goes, oh, okay, this is nice, and then I said, here's all the fundamental particles, but can you find the Higgs particle? Now, Don was part of the team at CERN, a team of like 3,000, 4,000 scientists that discovered
CERN in Switzerland, yeah.
Right. So he works at Fermilab as a senior scientist, but he's also connected with the CMS experiment at CERN. And the CMS experiment and the ATLAS experiment were responsible for discovering a new fundamental particle, which was huge news. The Higgs particle was discovered at CERN in 2012. So it was a particle that had been theorized for like 50 years, and it was really hard to find. And you had to wait for the experimental physics to catch up with the theoretical physics to finally prove that the theorists were right, that this Higgs particle that gives mass to everything in the universe existed. So I had these pieces about the standard model, and I showed Don, and I said, okay, so find the Higgs particle. And he's looking, and he says, I can't find them. And so I pointed out where I had embroidered them to exactly match the background of the piece and put them everywhere. And they matched so well that they were hidden. They were as hidden as the Higgs particle itself was for 50 years. And John was like, wow, I'm really into this art now. So he was very excited about that.
And he also knew that you grasped the physics.
Yeah, he knew that I understood some basic stuff about it that was important to communicate.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. Yeah. So this whole experience then, so then you become the first artist in residence at Fermilab.
Right.
And what does that entail? I mean, it had to be more than just making some textile art.
Well, Georgia and I kind of invented it as we went along.
Okay.
We had no idea what this was going to be. but we knew that there had to be an outreach component. So I had something like, instead of an open studio in my studio, I brought my works in progress, my sketchbooks, some of my small samples, and I set them up in the art gallery for, you know, the usual Friday afternoon wine and cheese do that the lab always has. And that open studio was part of the outreach. I had a couple of speaking engagements there and participated in one of their anniversary science days. So it involved a combination of outreach and a combination of doing my own research and learning and going home and making work in my studio. It ended up being something like 30 pieces. So it was a really huge project. And plus, Don introduced me to Michael Hoch, who is the founder of the Art at CMS project at CERN. And that was a collaboration effort between scientists and artists to use fine art as outreach. And so there was a whole group of us who were involved with that. And so I had to make a whole bunch of duplicate pieces so that that work could tour in Europe. And it's in Italy right now. And that's another form of outreach that was kind of an extension of the residency. And through Michael and the Art at CMS project, I got to go visit CERN, which was extremely cool.
Oh, yeah. So this, I mean, the high energy and physics guys, that's its own special international global club. And it sounds like then there is an artist component that is really that equivalent when it comes to high energy physics. Artists doing variations or using art in different ways to express what you do with textiles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And some of it was experiential, like a dance, video performance, musician. There's a rapper in our group. So that's a very diverse group of people.
Hmm. That's interesting. So, okay, different artists, different ways of expressing the same thing. Okay. I like that. Yep. So this must have, having success here, how long was that residency?
The residency lasted 2 years. I think the next group of residents were only 1 year, and I think they're on their seventh year now, past mine. So mm-hmm. It's a very successful program. So that was for me, it was 2 years, because honestly, I really needed the 2 years combined, you know, with what I was doing at Fermilab and what I was doing at CERN. It was really important for me to have that time.
Yeah.
It takes time to really synthesize those ideas and turn them into textile art.
Well, it needed a year just to figure out what the job was. So,
well, we kind of invented it as we went along, George and I.
That's great to be in on the ground floor. So then, I assume that you stay in touch with this. You're still involved with the program to some degree.
Yes, as a matter of fact, Georgia invited me to speak this month, earlier this month, for the Arts and Lecture Series at the lab.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I maintain a tight connection with them. Fermilab has opened so many doors for me. It's been a really wonderful experience. And, you know, when you say you were the first artist in residence at Fermilab, people like pay attention. They go, oh, well, let's take a look.
Also, doing that had to give you, I would think, considerable confidence that you can grasp science and express it through art. Must have taken you to a new level once you completed that work.
Yeah, actually, it did. It made me realize it wasn't a one and done after the wastewater treatment plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now the next one, and we're gonna, you know, obviously we're gonna run out of time, but I got to learn about the work you did with ocean acoustics and sound, because that whole thing. I mean, when before doing Fiber Talk, I did a podcast for 5 years on marine aquariums. Grew live coral in aquariums and of course studied reefs and so on and so forth. And one of the factors in coral reefs is all of the sounds in ocean, because animals use that more than we realize. And human sounds mess up animal behavior along the reefs. And so when I saw that you had actually gone on a boat, a ship, a research project to study acoustics, you had me, you know, you had me at acoustics. So how did that come about?
Well, you know, I started out in water. So the waterways paintings led to the wastewater treatment plant. And after 2 years of working with theoretical particle physics, I was thinking, you know, I'd really like to get back to a water theme. My son is an ocean acoustician. He studies ocean acoustics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I happened to mention to him, I said to him, you know, I'd really like to go to sea. I think that would be a really interesting thing to do. And he said, you know, Mom, it's funny you should mention that because I have a friend who's putting a project together. She's looking for an artist to go with her on her next trip. So that scientist was Dr. Jen Mixes-Olds at the University of New Hampshire, who is the director of the Center for Acoustics Research and Education. And she invited me to come along. Again, total amazing luck. I mean, I've had other projects where I had to work so hard to get in or so hard to get scientists to help me. And this one was like, oh my God, here's this scientist who like loves art museums, takes vacations in Europe and visits the Prada or whatever, you know? And it was just like, this was a great opportunity. And it was also the first time that I participated in science because I worked on the science crew just like everybody else on the science crew. I did my 12-hour shifts.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because isn't that true? On a boat, everybody's got to have jobs, yeah.
Everybody has to have a job. It's way too expensive to have somebody coming along as a freeloader.
Right.
But I was very happy to have a job. It was, if you didn't have a job, I mean, I think I would have gone crazy because it was intense. You're so far away from home. I was away for 3 weeks. You really do need something to do.
Yeah, yeah. So what was this project all about? Were they making measurements or were they actually injecting sound to see behavior? What was going on there?
It was a monitoring project. Okay. And the monitoring project was using both active and passive acoustics. So active acoustics is something that's on every ship ordinarily in the ocean because acoustics is used to discover what's happening underwater. So fishing boats use it to locate schools. Pilots use it to come in and out of harbors. Captains use it to make sure that they are the water depth where they're traveling is compatible with the draft of the ship. But the way that scientists used active acoustics on board the ship was to send the acoustics, you know, a ping of sound into the water column and to discover where organisms hung out in something called the plankton. And the plankton is a group of organisms that hang out in kind of like the top 200 meters of the ocean, basically. They're made up of larval fish. Some of the organisms live there their whole life. Some are temporary residents. And so the active acoustics helped identify how extensive the plankton was. And the passive acoustics was an array of special microphones, hydrophones they're called, that were sunk at 7 locations all along the eastern seaboard and collected information for at least a year, some a little bit longer. So we would go from site to site, and we would pick up the hydrophones, download the information, and then plunge the equipment back in because it was a 5-year project. And that data helped establish a baseline. It was just to monitor a baseline. What's happening with the sound environment in the ocean right now? And sound is really important in the ocean because light does not travel very well in water. After like the first 200 meters, light doesn't illuminate anything. So the kinds of observations that terrestrial scientists make about the ecosystem, you can't use what you're seeing. You must use sound. And also every organism is adapted to either produce sound or perceive sound or use sound to like navigate, find a mate, find food, hide from predators. So sound is a very crucial way to study oceans. And that's why this project was so exciting.
And it was so fun to see in your art the larval fish and the different things you did from the plankton layer, because a lot of people don't realize that most marine fish go through a larval stage, unlike guppies, which just hatch out baby guppies. And they're very different looking animals. And I really enjoyed just studying what you did to capture the looks of the larval fish. And so that had that there's, you know, there's another whole level of education that you had to get in your head. A lot of work.
Thanks. Yeah. That was, I used a lot of textile collage and a lot of interplay between light and dark values of the colors that I used in that project. I deliberately kept the colors monochromatic in both the acoustics part and the plankton part because there was so much complexity in other areas that it's really good to like kind of limit your choices somehow. Yeah. So that was really good. But yeah, I used stitching and beading and collage work and some quilting techniques to kind of put that project together.
Yeah. And again, then an exhibit comes out of that?
Yeah, actually, I had a chance to bring it to the University of New Hampshire for Ocean Discovery Days. And there were about 3,000 people who went through the building to take a look at that. It was the whole project was scheduled to go to D.C. to the Smithsonian Ocean for World Ocean Day. But, of course, that was canceled March 2020 because of COVID.
There we go.
Yep. It was a real bummer. But I have some irons in the fire for some future exhibitions for that. So we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So that one's still kind of in relative terms fresh.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Lots of miles yet to be realized out of that.
Yes.
That experience on the boat had to have been something you'll always remember, just doing the work and then watching other people work, the scientists, the whole education just in that.
Yeah, it was very valuable. I knew nothing about ocean acoustics. And to have that kind of full immersion experience was very enriching and very inspiring. But it took a little while after the trip was over to unpack it because it was so intense. It was a very steep learning curve. We took turns doing marine mammal watch or entering data in the science log, which, you know, you hear that on Star Trek, captain's log, suddenly something. Okay, there really is a science log. There really is a separate ship log even. One of the crew members taught me about celestial navigation. So it was great seeing all the nuts and bolts of science, but it was intense. Yeah. And it was long. And I really was so happy to get home after 3 weeks.
Yeah, I got to believe after something like that, you go home and for the following weeks, little lights keep going on. Oh, that's what that was all about. And that had to have been just an ongoing experience of things just coming to starting to realize that's what that meant. That's how that fits and piecing it together.
That is exactly right. And I think it was a whole year of that ping, ping, ping.
Was it that long?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All I can think is the Thanksgiving dinner table at your house has to be one interesting conversation. That's
either that or family members going, no, please. We've heard too much about this already. Let's talk about something else. No, you know, your family suffers.
Yep.
They suffer your obsessions.
Yep. That's well, hey, you're doing and trying different things, that's for sure. So talk about now, you have these experiences, you collect all this science in your head, you have an artist bent, you want to express it. Talk about how your textile arts have evolved. What are some of the tools and techniques you use to express all these science things that you're learning about?
Okay, I'm going to talk about the Ocean Acoustics Project for this one. I chose a silk background for the active and passive acoustics pieces. And these pieces are really big for, embroidery scale. Like, so the passive acoustics piece is about 36 inches square. And if you look carefully, the kind of silk that I used is called Dupiani. And I made identical squares and stitched them together, but I switched the grain lines around so that the Dupiani would kind of have a bit of sparkle to it.
Mm-hmm.
It catches the light in different ways, just like the surface of the ocean does. So that was one really nice choice. I loved working in that silk. It was a learning curve to figure out how to best handle it, but making that silk background really helped, like we talked about before, elevate the science content mm-hmm. by using a really elegant background. And then the passive acoustics piece, I decided to actually use some of the echograms, some of the actual sound recordings. So in the four quadrants of that passive acoustics piece, I've done some heavily embroidered surfaces that express the background noise in the ocean, for instance. The ocean itself is very noisy, even without human sounds. It's very, very noisy. There's abiotic sounds like winds and waves. And I used an overall stitching. They were actually couch thread, very thinly laid down couch threads that created that overall background noise in the ocean. And then closer to the center of the circle, there's something that looks a little bit more regular. That's a fly stitch that's done very narrowly with the legs pretty close together in a circle, and that's representing the sound waves that were collected for shipping. So there's shipping noise in there. Mm-hmm. Then there's a school of fish. Then there's dolphin noises and whale sounds. And then in the very center, I've embroidered equations. This was one of the equations my son helped explain to me. There's one equation that describes waves, all different kinds of waves. I mean, this is an equation that's used in physics, high energy physics, in acoustics, and other ways of measuring any kind of waves. So that's a basic wave equation in the middle. And in the very center of that ocean acoustics piece are three buttons. Those represented the huge floats that were on the hydrophone equipment itself. Mm. So I was including the equipment. I was including the equations used to come up with analyze the data that they were collecting from the hydrophones. I used the hydrophone data itself. And then in the very outside edge, I embroidered an equation that's used to measure ocean acidification. Because as global warming has more and more of an impact on the environment, the oceans are becoming more acidic, and that will affect the quality of sound transmission. So that's something that scientists are probably going to be studying over the next few decades.
Right. Now, two questions that have nothing to do with anything. One is, in the studying of the plankton layer and with global warming and global acidification, one of the negative results is it makes it hard for animals to deposit calcium, which many of them use for their shells and homes and other things. Are you seeing, is acidification starting to have a significant impact on the plankton layer and the animals and their ability to form their bodies?
Yeah, so skeletons and shells and so forth, it is becoming more and more difficult for animals to create those structures. And what's happening is that there's a kind of overgrowth of jellyfish, and soft-bodied animals.
So that's the end result of that, is the soft-bodied animals are able to start to dominate.
They're starting to flourish, right? There's conditions that favor them.
Yeah. Okay. That stuff makes me very nervous because it's at the very core of the food chain. And
And that's why we need projects to kind of like help. We need help from like all different kinds of playwrights, artists, you know, poets, historians, videographers, to help us put this picture together and connect it to our lives, because it's invisible, you know, all the stuff happening in the ocean.
Right. Yeah, we don't think of it. It's just a big bunch of water out there. But what's going on out there is, and as it gets more acidic and gets warmer, it just gets harder and harder for those animals. Because that's the part that people don't realize, is most of those animals have lived in incredibly stable environment, chemically very little variation for thousands and thousands of years. And so they're not built to adapt and evolve like land animals. And and as there's change, they just can't do it. They can't change fast enough. And it's very disturbing. Well, okay, that's another show, another time. When you're putting together this acoustic thing and you're talking about different sounds, Is that a doodle cloth and experimentation with different stitches to represent the different things that you want to show? Or is that something you do on the fly? How do you approach that?
I wouldn't call it a doodle cloth. I would say a little more like sampling. I create small samples. So, yes, I have a number of small samples that I use to develop both of those large pieces, because before you're going to sink yourself into a giant piece of expensive silk, you really want to have kind of a plan. I mean, I do change my plan occasionally, but it's good to have a place to start. So, yes, I do a lot of sampling, stitch tests, beading tests, and check out different colors of threads and different kinds of placement for the stitches and that sort of thing.
And does that start in your sketchbook, or does it start in your head and go right to thread?
I like to do both.
Okay.
And I think what's more important for me is to actually stitch on the materials themselves as a sample to understand, to educate my fingers, my eyes, and my brain about what each kind of component in the finished artwork, how it will behave in my hands, how it will behave with a certain stitch or a certain stitch quality, or what kind of surface texture am I looking for.
So like many things, the finished piece, the work that goes into that, there's an equivalent or maybe even more work that goes into just figuring out the various components.
Yeah, and testing out what stitches are going to work, what threads are going to work. If you're using 6-strand embroidery floss, how many strands do you want to use? How do you want to do color shifting? What's the density of the stitching like? Does it convey the science that I want it to convey? What is the best kind of stitch to represent a math equation? And that ended up being a wrapped backstitch. That is a very good stitch for expressing linear elements.
I see a book. Here comes a book. Stitches for science.
Learn your math by stitching. That's understanding math. I think I've missed the boat on that one.
Yeah. Not quite, huh? Okay.
Nope.
But it is interesting, because that's you said it there. The science has to come through your thread. So you can't just throw something down. You have to think that through.
Yes. And, it's not like scientific illustration, which scientific illustration is all the way at the other end of a continuum. So one end you have just art that's like inspired by science. And at the other end you have art that teaches scientists about science. What I'm aiming for is right in the middle. I want to use fine art that's grounded on real scientific principles, but is also emotionally expressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of many things that intrigued me, because I know a lady who is a scientific illustrator, and she'll use colored pencil, watercolors, whatever. But if she does a fish, then every scale, every fin ray, every color is exactly the way the animal is. So she's at that end of the spectrum. And then the other end is this abstract world, whatever it might be. So you're operating in kind of a gray area, really a flexible area, but flexible only to a degree.
Well, I had a scientist come up to me and look at my art and say, your art is abstract, but it means something.
Ah.
And I think that captures it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can see that now. Yeah, yeah. You bridge the two. Okay. Like that. What fun you have. I was really interested to see that you use a lot of beads.
Yes.
And actually kind of surprised, because it seems like for the work you do, that's a little fiddly. But they do something for you.
Well, all the stitching is fiddly, if you really want to get down to it.
Okay. You win.
But when you use beads, it's like somehow beads add an element of bling. And whatever honestly is going to like suck people in, I've got like 3 seconds to grab someone's attention. And if beads are going to do it, I'll use them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just was surprised because it just didn't seem like that would be in the toolbox. But then the more I studied it, it looked like anything and everything was in the toolbox. So,
yes, I use whatever means necessary to express the science.
So the studio becomes borderline hoarder in terms of you keep everything because you never know?
Well, actually, no, I have a really tidy studio. Oh. It's my sketchbooks that are messy, but my studio is very tidy. I keep a box full of some of the leftover fabric, but all the samples, all the notes, all the science learning. I have a whole shelf of science books, but my studio is pretty tidy, I would say.
Okay. All right. But the mess is in the books. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there has to be a mess somewhere. There has to be a scratch and erase and a,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, there has to be. There just simply has to be.
When I'm in the middle of a project, my studio can get really messy. But when the project is done, I can put everything away and move on and then make space for the new project. Mm.
A discipline all of us could learn from. Yes. Mm-hmm. So what is this? And we haven't even touched on some of the other science areas that you've covered. Do you start to want to orient yourself toward a field of science and explore more, or are you still pretty much a blank slate willing to try anything?
I am really focused for the next project and this last project on water. And my newest project that's in development at the moment is called Land and Sea Intimate Connections. And it's connecting the anoxic zone, this area of low oxygen in the Gulf of Mexico, to land use practices in the Mississippi River Basin, both in urban areas and rural farming communities. There are certain land use practices that are driving this increasing dead zone, low oxygen zone, that's killing life in the Gulf or driving it away. And so the ocean, things that have to do with water, I think that's the strongest pull for me.
Mm-hmm. So right back to that wastewater treatment plant that got in you.
Yes, that and some really cool stuff I'm learning about agriculture.
Yeah, I'll bet that's eye-opening. Oof. Ooh, stuff just getting washed right into the Mississippi, yeah.
And there are some also very powerful ways in which farmers and agriculture can solve climate change, this mm-hmm. issue of the warming planet. If we could change our agricultural practices just a bit, it's so hopeful, this piece of information, what I'm learning about things like perennial grains and no-till or low-till farming. It's really powerful.
So then this project is going to be able to educate from the Gulf all the way up the Mississippi.
Right. It's looking at land use practices in the Mississippi River Basin and how those impact what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, people, the Mississippi River Basin is gigantic. And
yes.
Yeah, we don't even realize. We think it's that thing that goes down the middle of the country, but what it draws from is huge. Yes.
No, the basin goes from like Montana and western New York. It's like a third of the country. It's huge.
Yeah. So the breadbasket of America and all the farming and all the runoff of that all ends up at some point in the Mississippi in one way or another.
Yeah, and all the urban stuff too.
Oh,
all
yeah,
the
that
phosphorus
too.
Coming from wastewater treatment.
That too. Yeah. Oh. That's okay. All right, we got to watch for that then. That's going to be interesting. And you're in the middle of that project.
Yeah, actually just starting it. So I'm really excited about this one.
The things you'll learn. Do you find yourself, when science things show up on, just as you go through the days, do they now stop you much more than they did before?
Yeah, it's really changed me fundamentally to learn about the scientific method and how scientists approach their work. So, when someone says to me, studies say, well, I want to know how big was the study, who financed the study, Was it peer-reviewed? Where was it peer-reviewed? Where has it been published? Has someone been able to duplicate that study? So is it like 12 people and your Aunt Sally did it kind of study, you know? But it makes you really think more deeply about what claims people attach to science. It makes you think much more critically about information that you find on the media.
Yeah, well, and there's a lesson for all of us right there, is that very thing. Yeah, when you hear something, ask that second and third question, not the first one, the second and third one. Who said that?
Yeah, who paid for that study?
Right.
You know, was it duplicated? Who duplicated it? I mean, that's the whole thing about science. It has to be, your results have to be repeatable.
Right. Yep. Yep, that's why they do it that way, so that we... when we get the answers, that we know that there's some substance behind them. Yes. Yeah. So it really, so then I can just tell in the way you talk, it has literally changed you.
It has changed my life. Yes. Yeah. And it's also made me realize that the reason I was so bad at school was because I didn't use art to learn my subjects. If I had been allowed to use art, I would have been done much better. Really?
Yep. Well, that's interesting too, in its own right. Everybody learns differently. And math class, art is not a way that they normally teach math, but it'd be interesting. Yeah, if you'd had a chance. Yep.
Yeah.
You'd have been a high-end mathematician. That would have been fun.
No, I really am happy to be an artist. Honestly, temperamentally, I can't stand to be told what to do. And science has so many rules that there's not a lot of wiggle room in science.
No. Well, Lindsay, this has been so much fun, and I'll tell you, I really admire what you've accomplished. It's very impressive, and your ability to absorb and keep your mind open and learn is really admirable.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for having me and allowing me to use your podcast to show people science doesn't have to be scary.
Yes, so true there. Yep. All right. Well, thanks, Lindsay, and thanks to everybody for listening.